Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And look at the calendar, folks. It's getting a little late in December. Time to look back and consider this year of 2013. What a year. We're going to hear from two people today who have had quite a year for some very different reasons. But we begin this hour with a very special look at the diversity of the U.S. economy. We got a hint of that yesterday when we told you about this map of median incomes in states, cities, and counties around the nation based on the latest census figures released this week. Our producing partner, WNYC, created this interactive map where you can see where the median income, what the exact middle is in your own community. So we asked you out there to go see where you fit. If you find that you are right in the middle, we said, contact us. Tell us your profession, how you feel about your life right now. Well, the map became so many names out there as we got contacts from all over the country, hearing from a diverse group of folks inhabiting the middle. Not average or middle class, median, smack dab in the middle in places all over the country. Well, to help us bring this median income map alive, we've got four examples, four great and very, very different examples of folks in the middle. Margaret is a self-employed mud logger in Dickinson, North Dakota. Margaret, I'm going to call you North Dakota oil boomer. Welcome.
Thank you, John. That's quite flattering. I'm going to have to, put that in my resume perhaps next time.
And Margaret McGlynn, you are single, right?
Yes, correct. I'm single.
And you're self-employed, and how much do you make?
Just shy of 100 a year, so 80 to 100.
80 to 100, and that is median in the oil-booming state of or community of North Dakota, right, Margaret?
Yes, absolutely. I'm doing well, but it would definitely be one of the more modest oil rig salaries.
Okay, also with us is Tim Wood, who's I've dubbed New England journalist. You're the editor of a weekly newspaper in the Cape Cod area. Hey, Tim.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Were you surprised to discover you were in the middle?
We kind of knew that. We keep tabs on things here at our newspaper, so we pretty much know what the income levels are in our area.
And collectively, your income falls where?
It falls about the middle of the range for our region, about $60,000 to $70,000 a year. My wife is self-employed, so her income can go up and down.
All right. And Tanya joins us. Tanya Lundberg joins us from Northville, Michigan. Tanya, I've dubbed you Michigan Six Figures. You're doing pretty well here. What's your number?
Our household income is about $185,000 a year for 2013.
And what do you and your husband do?
I'm an attorney, and my husband is a web developer.
Were you surprised to learn that you're in the middle?
It often does not feel like we are in the middle for our community, for Northville. But in southeastern Michigan, I'm not surprised if we're in the middle.
Javiz joins us. Javiz Cruthard. He's in Pompano Beach, Florida. Javiz, welcome.
Thank you, Ari.
Now, I've dubbed you Florida Single Dad. What's your number?
I'm at 33,000.
And as a single dad, how do you feel about being in the middle? Do you feel middle-ish, or do you feel more like you're closer to the bottom?
I definitely feel closer to the bottom.
And what do you do?
I'm a distribution supervisor for a oxygen company.
Oxygen company. You distribute medical devices?
Yeah, they're portable devices that they make oxygen for our patients.
Were you surprised to learn that you were in the middle in your community?
Definitely, yes.
And
I was very surprised by that.
What do you think that says about Pompano Beach, Florida? Tell me a little bit about the community there.
It's not nice. I don't think it's nice, at least, compared to the other places I lived in. So finding out that I was in the middle was a little shocking because I expected it was weird to me.
All right. I want to ask each one of you, and again, we've got Florida single dad, New England journalist, North Dakota oil boomer, and Michigan Six Figures. To each one of you, are you feeling like your trend line is up, that you're heading higher than the middle, or are you slipping back below the middle? Tanya, Michigan Six Figures, you're first.
we're trending up. Both of our jobs seem secure. We both get annual raises. And of course, as an attorney, I hope to make partner within the next 5 to 6 years.
So that's pretty positive.
We think so, yeah.
Congratulations. Margaret, about you? North Dakota oil boomer. You moving forward or slipping back?
Oh, definitely forward. Like, I will say the price of oil can be a little bit erratic. So that's always a concern with the consistency of our jobs, you know, coming forward in the next decade. But for now, me and my colleagues, and particularly people my age, like, it's been such a nice opportunity to be able to get out of student debt so quickly out of college. So, being able to go into our 30s and onwards without any debt, yeah, I definitely upwards.
So you're 28 years old.
Correct, yep.
And you're unmarried. You don't mind me sharing these personal details with our colleagues here, do you?
No, not at all. If anybody knows any, like, hot single guys, you know.
All right,
hello.
Great, good. That's why we're here in public radio. And you are living with your mother there in North Dakota, right?
Yeah, and I would like to say in my defense, that's very unique to this area as well, because the rental prices here went up very quickly after the oil boom. So a lot of people my age have ended up moving in back with their parents if they didn't buy before the prices became ridiculous. It's like New York City loft prices for the prairies, and that's not reasonable. Locals are not going to pay that.
All right, but so you must be socking it away. Do you have a savings account?
Yes, savings, you know, maxing out my retirement. I think I'm fairly responsible. I have fun, but it's important to remember that the oil industry is erratic and, you know, our salaries aren't guaranteed every year.
28 years old, single, living with mom and maxing out her retirement. Tim, New England journalist there in Chatham, Massachusetts, in the Cape Cod area. How does that make you feel?
Well, I think we're sort of treading water here, so I feel a little ambiguous about that. But my newspaper does okay. We've managed to sort of hold the line as opposed to other newspapers. But we haven't really been able to increase our salaries too much. Health insurance costs go up every year. That's a major issue for us. We live comfortably. You know, we send our kids to public school, but we give them good, healthy food. But we don't have any real luxuries, I don't think.
It sounds like you're doing a great job as a parent and as a provider. But what's your situation as far as retirement and savings is concerned?
We don't have much savings. We just bought a car and we use some of our savings for that, so we wouldn't have a car payment. We both, my wife and I, have IRAs that we try to max out every year. I don't have a 401k. Saving for college for our two boys is right now sort of out of our reach, and that, you know, causes us some sleepless nights.
All right, so Javiz Cruthard, you're sort of at the low end numerically speaking, but again, in Pompano Beach, Florida, you're in the middle. Javiz, do you feel like you're moving upwards or slipping back?
I feel like I'm kind of stagnant because anytime I've gotten a raise, it seems like the spending power of my dollar has gone down. So it seems like I'm always just where I was before. I don't really see much of a difference. I can't really save any money. I used to put money into the 401k that I have, and I had to stop doing that because it was actually taking too much money away that I could actually use for bills that I have right now. Even as far as my daughter's concerned, I haven't been able to put anything towards her college education at all. So I don't feel like that I've moved at all. Even though I've gone up with my yearly pay, I don't feel like it's doing me any better at all.
Now, for you, if you were going to do something, make a radical step of one kind or another that might push you ahead of the middle, or improve your situation, or make you feel like you weren't stagnant, what do you think that would be?
I've looked into is just opening my own business. I know there's risk involved with that, but that as far as I'm concerned, I think that's my best option is opening my own business.
All right, so we've got Javiz Cruthard, who's Florida single dad. We've got Tim Wood, New England journalist in Chatham, Massachusetts. We've got Margaret McGlynn, who's a North Dakota oil boomer, and we've got Tanya Lundberg, who's an attorney and pulls in six figures in Michigan. Any questions any of you have for any other of you about your experience? What are your impressions of this very, very different experience of living in the middle? Anybody?
I'd be curious as to how health insurance and healthcare costs affect other people. I know for us, we pay 13 to 15% of our income for both insurance and healthcare costs. And if we didn't have that expense, even half that expense, we'd feel we'd be doing a lot better economically.
Javiz, you've alluded to your healthcare issue, right?
Yeah, it's I'd say it's comparable to his as well. I've opted not to take it because my daughter is on her mother's insurance, so I'm not really concerned about her insurance. As far as myself, I don't use my company's insurance. Although with the law passing, I'll have to make use of it, and that's actually bothering me.
Tanya?
So, I honestly have no idea what we spend on healthcare. It comes directly out of my husband's paycheck, and we just pay our co-pays when we have to go to the doctor.
Boy, that is...
I don't think it affects us.
That is a radically different experience from our other two. Margaret, how about you? You're 28 years old. You're going to join Obamacare? You're one of the target population there.
Yeah, I know. I don't think I have much of a choice. I just got a letter the other day that my health insurance was going up. So I do notice that. I mean, you've probably noticed my accent. I've lived in countries where you don't have to pay health insurance at all. And so it's always a bit jarring.
So any final thoughts from any of you about discovering that you're in the middle?
Well, I'd just like to say about North Dakota and the oil money here. Something North Dakota does really well that I find very charming is that their status symbols aren't as outwardly visible as a place like North Dakota or London. So you'll be sitting in a bar here next to an oil millionaire, and you wouldn't even know that. So I think visibly our community remains very staunchly middle class wherever you look.
Interesting. So the diverse experience, it's America. You might be sitting next to a millionaire in North Dakota, Tanya Lundberg, doing very, very well, doesn't even know what she's spending on health insurance, while Tim Wood and Javiz definitely know exactly what the percentage is of their health care. The middle is a very, very different experience. As far as I'm concerned, you guys are way above the middle in our book. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Javiz Cruther, Tim Wood, Margaret McGlynn, and Tanya Lundberg. You can go to thetakeaway.org and see their statistics and learn a little more about them. So the map that inspired those folks to contact us, you can check out at thetakeaway.org. It's made by our friends at producing partner WNYC, and it relies on the newest income data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Some more data points. George from Plano, Texas says, my wife and I are in the middle tax bracket, but it feels like we're losing ground as our income stagnates. Even if taxes stay the same, we're seeing backdoor taxes in the form of fees and rising costs like tuition, licensing, and virtually all the things needed to change our station. And here from Grand Prairie, Texas, I'm in the lower end, but I'm climbing up. This is mainly due to some major lifestyle changes in the past year that I've made to use my money much more efficiently. Call us with your wisdom, your tips, your situation, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Leadership is about what you can make happen through your powers of persuasion and smarts. It is also how you respond to extraordinary circumstances. An example from each of those this hour. Later, the smarts and insights about luck and fate from 28-year-old man, Booker Prize winner and author of the epic The Luminaries, Eleanor Catton. But now an example from politics. After he had the smarts and persuasive power to get elected as governor of his own state of Colorado from being mayor of Denver, John Hickenlooper faced some truly extraordinary circumstances. 100-year flooding this year and accompanying landslides carved up mountain communities that will never be the same. That brought out one side of the governor, while the passage of a ballot measure to legalize marijuana was a completely different kind of challenge. To begin a series of conversations over the next 2 weeks, a series we're calling What a Year, a few minutes of looking back at 2013 with Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper.
Every time when you begin to think you're on top of it is just when things fly out of control. So I'm very cautious not to ever let myself think that. What we have done, I mean, unfortunately, we've had too much practice with natural disasters. It is so fast, and so it happens so quickly, and each hour, each day is an opportunity either gained or lost.
You know, a lot of politicians get into your line of work because they want to change the world, but what's it like as a leader to see the world change forever as it did in the Boulder area? I mean, those communities will never be the same.
After the floods hit Boulder, and again, that devastation extended all the way out the Platte Valley to Nebraska. It was a wide swath. And even though it'll never be the same, part of what we tried to say from the beginning was, we're going to come back and rebuild stronger than we were before. And that became an important... It's funny, when I first called Peter Shumlin, who's the governor of Vermont, and gave us a tremendous amount of guidance, even as the floods were still there, he called me out of the blue and just said, hey, we went through Hurricane Irene 2 years ago. Here's what we did. Here's what was important. And one of the things he said was, you know, people have lost so much, you can't come back and just build it the way it was. You've got to, from the beginning, look at every culvert, every road that's washed away, every bridge. We're going to find a way to make it stronger and better than it was before, so that when we look back some years in the future, this wasn't it wasn't all for naught, that there was something that came out of this that was beneficial.
What do you make of a decision by the voters in your state to do something that maybe it would be pretty risky for a politician to sign up for on his or her own? For instance, the decision to legalize marijuana in Colorado. Did you say to yourself, oh, great, thanks a lot, people who elected me?
I sort of did. You know, there's no question that the war on drugs has been a disaster. I mean, look at how many people we put in prison for nonviolent crimes. The accessory damage has been widespread. But no governor wants their state in something like this to be the guinea pig and to have to kind of create whole new levels of regulation out of whole cloth. And to be at odds with the federal law. I mean, that creates a whole different set of complications of a significant magnitude. I would have much preferred to have... You know, I thought Washington would do a great job. I thought California has always been the cutting edge. I thought those guys would probably go first. But, you know, once it happens, you step up and you say, all right, how are we going to do this the best we possibly can? In a funny way, it's so different, but it's similar to kind of recovery efforts after disaster, in that you want to say, we're going to come out of this better than we were before. And it doesn't seem possible in the near term, but somehow we've got to keep working at this and figure out a way that we're gonna be better off from it.
Well, the voters certainly decided that taxes should pay for whatever trouble is going to be caused by the legalization of marijuana, and that you discovered in the election in November. As a very public person, and we're talking to John Hickenlooper, who's the governor of Colorado. As you look back on a year, how do you balance the sense of it was a good or bad year in your public life versus it was a good or bad year in your private life? Do they go together? Are they completely different?
No, I mean, they're pretty different. I mean, I still keep my private life relatively private. You know, I take the public as my job and really kind of my calling in life, and love doing it. I can't imagine, even in the worst times, I can't imagine a better, for someone like me, a better job. And I love it. It doesn't mean it doesn't get in the way of you know, some of the things. You know, sometimes I want to have a quiet weekend and just hole up with my family, and you can't. All of a sudden there's a flood, or there's, you know, some other demand on your time that pulls you away. So there is that dynamic tension, but you know, that's part of what you accept when you take these jobs, right? You recognize that there's some sacrifice involved for the opportunity, you know, to work with some of the smartest people I could ever imagine, doing some of the most difficult challenges and trying to, you know, figure out solutions. It's pretty exhilarating, even when they're long days.
loves a challenge, thrilled with his job, wouldn't want to do anything else, distinctive name that's really, really memorable, probably would fit on a long bumper sticker. John Hickenlooper, are you running for president?
No, I'm not going to run for president. It's funny. I was talking this weekend to some friends and, trying to figure out what my next step. I'm running for re-election as governor next year, and hopefully we can win that, and I get to do this for four more years. But then there's still the challenge of what is next, and I'm not sure I'd do so well in Washington, so I'm not sure that's in the field of vision immediately. I did see that Bud Selig is going to be leaving as commissioner of baseball. Now, that would be a great job. Think about what kind of a challenge and a delight that would be, although I think he's going to leave sooner than when I'll get finished as governor, unfortunately.
Well, we'll call Bud up and see if there's an opportunity for you there, as long as you give us a call when you decide to either rule out running for president, which you notably didn't do right there, or whether you decide to actually run for president, okay?
All right, fair enough.
Deal?
Deal, but don't hold your breath.
All right, John Hickenlooper is the governor of Colorado. Thanks so much.
You bet, my pleasure.
We'll have more of those what-a-year conversations between now and the end of 2013. Also, we've been getting reports from the middle. Here's someone from John Hickenlooper's neck of the woods. I'm in the middle. I just moved to Denver from Oklahoma and more than doubled my pay. I know the cost of living is higher, but not by that much. Give us your report from the median income in your community. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. The week the Chinese landed a spacecraft on the moon, there was another more earthly bit of rivalry with the United States. A report of a confrontation at sea confirmed now a near collision between a Chinese warship and a U.S. guided missile cruiser on December 5th. These events are not unprecedented, but they do signal that the prevailing rules of the game in the Pacific may be changing as China raises its profile as a military power. That will certainly be one of the themes for Senator Max Baucus, who has just been nominated as President Obama's ambassador to China. Stephanie Klein Albrand is director of the Asia-Pacific Program at the United States Institute of Peace. She spends a lot of time in China. Today she joins us from Washington, D.C. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So do you think there is a deliberate pattern of confrontation taking place now in the waters around China?
This type of incident, it's not the first time, and I think it does underscore the fast-growing maritime rivalry between the U.S. and China, and it also highlights the fact that China is increasingly irritated over what they see as unfair surveillance practices by U.S. military. And so, this is sort of the third incident in a string of incidents that have become public, actually, because many of these incidents don't become public. We saw an American EP-3 surveillance aircraft collide with a Chinese jet fighter in 2001. We saw the U.S. surveillance ship, the Impeccable, surrounded by five Chinese ships in 2009. So this is just like a more recent incident in a similar line as those earlier incidents.
Do you think it has anything to do with the airspace affair over the disputed islands with Japan that the U.S. also seemed to take a deliberately confrontational approach to with its military planes?
Well, I think that people are concluding that this could be reflecting a growing willingness by the Chinese to engage in potentially dangerous behavior, and that it also reflects the aspirations of China's People's Liberation Army, whose budget has soared to almost $2 billion, according to some estimates. So now it's really the world's second highest military budget behind the U.S., and that money's going towards warships, strike aircraft, missiles, et cetera. And people think that it could be a sign that the PLA Air Force and Navy are trying to flex their muscles a bit more.
And maybe with good reason. I mean, the Chinese landed a spacecraft on the moon this week.
That's right.
Certainly
That's
a,
right.
a That's milestone right. for them. I mean, they have every reason to note their technological prowess, and
right.
the place to do that is the Pacific.
That's right. And so that's where it comes up against the U.S., which, of course, is a Pacific power and has for, at least the last quarter century been carrying out routine monitoring, is what they call it, of Chinese military assets. But in recent years, as China's, economic and political power and military power as well continues to rise, they're increasingly irritated by this. And there's also a disagreement between the U.S. and China about where and when such a surveillance can happen. It's a disagreement about interpretation over the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea. And those types of things mean that it's possible that this is hardly the last such incident that we'll see.
Do you think that eventually the United States will have to recognize or at least get into a debate about the notion of parity in the Pacific, that if the U.S. is going to have surveillance going close to the Chinese coast, that then China will be permitted to hang out, you know, near San Francisco Bay? And is Max Baucus, who may be the new U.S. ambassador to China, the person to sort of lead the next few years?
You know, Max Baucus will definitely, he's got a lot on his plate going in as U.S. ambassador. Not all these decisions, certainly decisions with regard to Pentagon matters are not necessarily made by, you know, the ambassador on the ground. But I think that there really was a hope that as China gathered the ability to conduct its own missions within the U.S. exclusive economic zone, as you mentioned, they've already done that off of Guam, and I think Hawaii as well. There was a sense that China would then be less averse to us doing that to them because now they would see the benefits, right? And that's why this incident is so worrying, because it seems to run counter to those developments.
Stephanie Klein-Albrand, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stephanie Klein-Albrand is director of the Asia-Pacific Program at the United States Institute of Peace. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. When the Edward Snowden leak debacle broke, the president tried to get out ahead of the matter by claiming that he always wanted to take a fresh look at the ways in which the National Security Agency was collecting data and clarify the rules. Well, a panel of presidential advisors appointed to do just that has released its recommendations. Some of what the NSA is doing, this panel doesn't like, including sifting data from Americans' phone communications, creating pipelines from the private sector to monitor Americans' behavior, and it's recommended that spying on the private communications of foreign leaders be limited or curtailed. But the panel did say it believed it was fine for the president to have access to these data, not for the NSA or other spy agencies to have this capability on their own. David Sanger joins us now, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome.
Thanks, John. Great to be back with you.
So what is the likelihood these recommendations will be followed and that we would even know that they were followed if it really involves the NSA changing its behavior?
Well, one of them, a minor one, relatively minor one, the president's already rejected. One of the recommendations is that the NSA director not be the same person as the commander of U.S. Cyber Command, which does cyber defense and cyber offense. Right now, those two jobs are held by one person. The president's already said that our cyber future and our surveillance future are so inextricably linked that you can't separate those jobs. But all the body language from the White House yesterday was that the remaining recommendations, or at least most of them, and there are 46 in this 300-page report, are likely to be adopted in whole or in part. And I think if you had to go summarize where the committee came out here, what they said was, while many of these operations should continue, with a few notable exceptions, they either have to do it with much greater oversight or approval from the president, from the Congress, or from the courts. They said, for example, that if you're going to spy on foreign leaders, that decision has to be made by policymakers who are weighing the economic and diplomatic downsides, not just by intelligence officials.
But doesn't this create a legal morass in the sense that the FISA court is supposed to be the kind of probable cause arbiter here of whether something is permitted or not? To add the president into that chain sort of makes it sound a little like the old Iran-Contra days where you're not permitted to do something. Oh, we'll just have the president sign a directive and then, boom, we've got another form of blank check.
I think that that may be conflating two different parts of the recommendations. The FISA court would still be the only one that ruled about looking at the telephone metadata of Americans.
Right.
That's what it looks at. But the difference is that they would have to issue, if the recommendation was taken up, they would have to issue an individual order. So they couldn't just have a blanket order and then some analysts say that John Hockenberry's telephone record should be looked at. Instead, they would have to go to the court and say, this Hockenberry fellow is very suspicious, and get an individual order for that.
Finally, in principle, does this group of advisors think that the president should have access to the raw data from the NSA or no, that it should always be filtered by the National Security Establishment and that under very strict rules, according to this document?
The president always has access to the raw data that underlies the intelligence assessments he's given. How much of that he wants to go through is another question. You could argue that during the Iraq War, President Bush would have been advised to go through a little bit more of it, right?
Right.
On the other hand, one of the interesting elements here is that for the first time, this would extend to foreigners who are monitored the same kind of privacy protections that Americans have under the Privacy Act. So, for example, if we collected information about a foreigner, an ordinary citizen here, that could not be released to other government agencies or to the public, just as information collected about Americans has to be protected. And that's an interesting concept. It doesn't extend full Fourth Amendment protections to foreigners, but it does enable the U.S. to say, we're not just collecting on your citizens and then handing the data around the U.S. government.
A rule book after the fact for the NSA from a presidential panel. David Sanger, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. You heard some playful candor about the political headaches associated with legalized marijuana in Colorado from that state's governor, John Hickenlooper, a few moments ago. But with the changing of the laws regarding marijuana comes the inevitable conversation change around the dinner table in homes and communities as well, where medical marijuana is available, as well as in the two states where it is legal, Colorado and Washington. Here's a number. Between 2005 and 2013, the percentage of eighth graders who saw regular marijuana use as risky fell from 74 to 61%. For high school seniors, it went from 58 to 40%. That's from an annual survey from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Taken with other federal data, marijuana usage among high schoolers seems to be steadily increasing, while use of alcohol and harder drugs is decreasing. In addition, the active agent in pot, THC, is much more highly concentrated in the pot available today than was ever the case a generation ago. To help us understand what's going on here is Roger Rothman, a professor emeritus at the University of Washington School of Social Work. He's been studying the effects of marijuana use on adults and teens for over 25 years. Let's start with you, Roger, for a moment. We've also got a parent on the line who's dealing with this directly. Roger, what's the public health issue right now as states like Washington and Colorado move into a fully legalized pot zone?
Well, the public health issues, of course, cross both teenagers and adults. One of the concerns is, will more people drive under the influence of marijuana? Will more people who use marijuana use it heavily and become dependent? But for teenagers, the concern really is, will more teenagers have access to marijuana? And will more begin using it early in their teenage years and use it heavily?
Alex Sabia is a mother, two kids, age 16 and 12, on the line from Seattle. Alex, welcome.
Thank you.
How terrifying is the conversation about pot around your dinner table, or is it just another one of those things?
I think it's not terrifying at all, but there is a concern, of course, that I have about pot use in teenagers. And with my 16-year-old in particular, we've started having discussions I've been having these discussions for about 8 or 10 years with them. So it's nothing new. I think what's new now is that with the legalization, there is a question of more access for sure.
And does that more access, Roger Rothman, mean that kids are going to be acquiring, this THC agent from pot earlier and that has developmental issues at age 16 or at age 12?
You know, I think there are definitely developmental issues. And so we really want to prevent young people from using marijuana, beginning using marijuana early and using it heavily. But the question of access is not something that has suddenly run out of the barn when marijuana was legalized. I mean, young people were telling us in surveys that they easily were able to obtain marijuana long before marijuana became legalized. So the real challenge is how to do what Alex is doing, how to have more families have that conversation, begin early, have multiple conversations, and to influence the norms of young people as to what's cool and what's not cool, not simply to rely on preventing access.
So, Alex, from your kids' perspective, is legalization reducing the coolness factor for pot, and is that likely to reduce an interest in it?
I don't think so. That's a very good question that I haven't thought about. For me, legalization of marijuana, the reason that I voted to legalize was simply to regulate and tax. So the regulation, I'm thinking down the road, there are going to be just like cigarettes, which have higher nicotine or lower nicotine. It'll be the same thing with pot, so that maybe there will be a teen pot that's cool. That's kind of along the lines that I'm thinking. For me, though, it's important for my kids to know where I stand on it, which is that I'm against any kind of consumption of pot, although I'm not against drinking. And I'm against it for a couple of different reasons. And I think the conversations that I have with my kids are different from when my parents would have had them as well. My parents would have said, it's bad for you, don't do it. I trust that you won't do it. My stand is that I'm pretty sure that at some point my 12-year-old and my 16-year-old will be trying it. What I'm trying to do is make sure that it's under safe circumstances.
Your 16-year-old's already tried it, right?
I would not know that. I actually don't know the answer to that.
All right. How do you reconcile the issue of drinking is okay, but smoking pot you're against? And how do you throw cigarettes into all of this? The public health risks there, of course, are completely clear.
Right. And I'm totally against anything that you're going to put into your lungs. Eating it is another thing altogether, but I'm still personally against it. So the way that I reconcile that is, number one, I'm of European descent. My family, when I was growing up, we were allowed to drink wine at dinner. My kids, when we're around the dinner table, that's not something that I'm going to say no to. But pot, my understanding is that we really don't have as much information about pot. THC, as we have about alcohol. Roger, you might tell me different.
All right, well, let's get a final thought from Roger. Alex Sabia, thanks so much. Roger?
I'd like the listeners to be aware that there's really a very helpful booklet on parents planning to have a conversation with young people about marijuana. And it's on a website, and the website name is learnaboutmarijuana.org. learnaboutmarijuana.org. And on that website, it's a University of Washington website, there is a booklet that can be downloaded for parents on how to prepare for a conversation with young people about marijuana.
Well, Roger, thanks so much. Roger Ruffman is a professor emeritus at the University of Washington School of Social Work. And Alex Sabia, Washington State parent of two kids aged 16 and 12. Alex, particularly, thanks so much for letting us into your dinner table conversations there. Alex and Roger, thanks.
Thank you.
Back to the middle now. If you're in the median income zone in your community, what's that feel like? From Richmond Beach, California, I'm probably middle to low income bracket in my community, but upper income bracket nationally. It's all relative. We'd love to know your story. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Very different experiences around the country. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This hour with someone who had quite a year, 28-year-old Eleanor Catton won the 2013 Man Booker Prize with her over 800-page novel about a murder mystery and a love story during the gold rush in New Zealand in the mid-1800s. It's a novel about luck and fate, and it is structured intricately, like a cathedral almost. Each of 12 characters represent the signs of the zodiac, and the luminaries, that's the title of the book, represent the wandering planets. It is very precisely structured, as it is also a tour de force, a great read, according to reviewers. Catton herself is a New Zealander by a certain kind of luck. One parent ran away there to escape the Vietnam War draft. The other side of the family chose New Zealand to escape their fear of a nuclear attack during the Cold War. But the daughter of a philosopher and a librarian was perhaps fated to write a novel of ideas with a vast library of characters. In this conversation, what a year, Eleanor Catton, who has been humbled and a little terrified by her early success, says she is looking forward to moving into a bigger house finally, and to getting her own writing room.
That is on the cards for next year. Yeah, at the moment I don't have my own study. I've never had my own study at home, as I've only got a two-bedroom apartment and my partner gets the study while he's legitimately studying for his PhD.
Not because he's a poet, because he's studying for his PhD, he gets the study. The fact that you're a novelist doesn't rank.
We just worked that out in our own relationship in our own way, and I was quite alarmed actually. There came out this, you know, all of this very angry ranting online about gender politics and my relationship and how, you know, my partner was oppressing me by...
Capitulated, yes.
Right.
Right. Well, permit me to say personally how intimidating it is to talk to someone who wrote an 850-word second novel that won the Man Booker Prize without her own study. Okay. But I think that you've been psychoanalyzed quite enough, I suspect. But for me, the biographical detail that fascinates me the most is that you have a set of parents, one philosopher, one librarian. Mm-hmm. And so this book is in many ways a fusion of structure and ideas that seems to me there's the librarian, there's the philosophy. And you've managed to combine, I think, a structure here with a set of ideas that – I think is unusual in this era of novels about, you know, what I'm feeling and what my, you know, inner psychology is all about. There's something very disciplined about all of this.
Right. The approach that I took in writing the book, I suppose, when I started researching the years of the New Zealand Gold Rush, this is kind of the, I guess, the early 1860s through to about the late 1880s, the years that I was looking at in the very early stages of the book. I became very fascinated in the contemporary ideas at that time of what a so-called self-made man really constitutes. Mm-hmm. The 19th century as a whole was a century that saw just such an incredible shift from a kind of a, like really broadly, from a collective way of understanding the self through to a very strongly individual way of understanding the self. And a gold rush is such a mythical, kind of primal or archetypal set piece in my mind, or in my kind of cultural imagination anyway, because it's an arena that somebody walks into in order to quote unquote make their fortune, but really what they're doing is they're just walking into a natural environment and plucking a mineral out of the ground, and that to me fused the ideas of fate on the one hand and individual enterprise on the other really beautifully. And straight away I started following the double meaning of the word fortune, which means obviously both a great deal of money on the one hand, but also your kind of cosmically determined fate.
Well, there's all kinds of tension between this idea of determination and fate and this idea of luck and good fortune. Let me read you a quote. I mean, there are a lot of quotes I could have chosen here, but again, this one – really seems to sort of sum it up. "I have been declared the luckiest man in Hokitika," he said as he handed Crosby Wells his envelope. "I have been advised to keep hold of my luck and to share my luck around and to confess the secret of my luck, and I don't know what else. I fancy that the story you told me was not at all true. Mr. Wells, you simply knew what would happen to a man foolish enough to walk into the Reserve Bank with a nugget of that size at this hour of the day." It seems to me that is the perfect sort of collision of the predestiny of astrology and this idea of throwing the dice.
That's interesting. Yeah, the character who is talking there is one of the two, in my mind, most central characters in the book. The book's title refers, is an astrological term, the luminaries. It refers to the sun and the moon, which in astrology act in partnership. And it was actually one of the first ideas in astrology that really kind of spurred my interest in it as a field of study. The sun and the moon kind of very briefly govern our external and internal selves. The sun is kind of our flourishing self that we project out into the world, and the moon is our inner self that we hide from the world. And because in the book these are literalized into actual people, that they dance around one another in their, you know, love affair and interactions with one another, had to in some way reflect that externality and internality when I was kind of designing the book's architecture.
Well, I mean, based on this book and, you know, based on philosophy, there are really only three options. And I gather you're going to have no response to the three I will present. Either you are a genius, or you are incredibly lucky, or the stars have aligned and it allowed you to pursue this structure and allow it to succeed.
What about hard work, though? I'm sure that that's a fourth option.
You cheated.
I guess that was a cheat, yeah. Uh-huh.
So what do you think is the key pitfall of this amazing year for you as a creative artist?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, ever since the Booker Prize, I have been quite alarmed at the degree of visibility that I now kind of have as a creative person. I feel very uncomfortable with that, actually, in most respects. I really like talking about writing and reading and the books I love and, you know, and hearing other writers talk and that kind of thing. But being a public figure is something else entirely. And I've kind of had my first taste of what it feels like to have people want to spin a story out of things that you say, you know. And in fact, how incredibly easy it is to spin a story out of absolutely anything that somebody says. Mm.
You are a novelist, right?
Yeah, I'm something similar there. But
what can I get her to say about sheep in New Zealand? Yes.
Well, I think there's about six sheep to every one human, but that's about that's the only fact I know about sheep.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've had a great year. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to going home, actually. I haven't been back to New Zealand since early October, so I've just been on the road for a really long time, and nothing quite feels real yet. You know, going back home and settling into my life back there and kind of taking stock is going to be wonderful.
First question when you get home, how's that PhD coming, dear?
Oh, yes.
Yes, you'll need his help moving, right?
Yeah, he's had a... a lot of changes in his year, too. So got a lot of taking stock to do.
Eleanor Catton, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on a great year. Have a great 2014.
Cheers. Will do.
At the end of the hour, we bounce back to the middle. People who have a median income in their own community, where do you land? Are you slipping or climbing?
My name's Wayne. I'm from Clearwater, Florida. I am stuck right in the middle, and I can't seem to go up, and I retire in 5 years. Am I going to be able to retire?
Tell us your situation at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.